Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through each and every Newbery medal-winning book, and then we talk about it. I'm Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
And this time we're talking about 1952's Ginger Pie by Eleanor Estes, which won the Newbery Medal in 1952. Thanks for listening so far to the first 30 seconds of this, 20 seconds. Don't forget that before we go on, I sometimes forget to mention this, but you can email us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com if you're interested in, telling us what you think about Ginger Pie or Miss Hickory or any of the other books, or if you're interested in just yelling at us for taking so long between episodes this time. I do want to say, not my fault. Whose fault is it, Rebecca?
It's mine.
Yeah, but that's okay. We are a forgiving podcast, forgiving of ourselves. Rebecca, in the month that it took you to read Ginger Pie, what else were you reading?
I was reading several things, and I did neglect Ginger Pie.
Neglected?
And I ask forgiveness.
We forgive.
Thank you. I mentioned this on the last podcast that I had started this, and I finished it, everyone. I finished Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and...
It was a big good push
riddance.
At our good house.
Riddance. I finished it before the deadline of when the other people were supposed to finish it. I also finished King by Jonathan Eig, which was incredible. It was also very thick. It was a big book that took me a while.
That's what they say about Martin Luther King, incredible and thick.
I just feel like that's a tad inappropriate.
Sorry, Coretta.
This biography was... You sound like a troll, just FYI.
I am sorry if Coretta took offense.
We really like Martin Luther King in this house, and we respect his work. And this biography was very well done. I thought it was very insightful, and is pretty detailed about his life and his work and his relationships, and... I really appreciate some of the insight that Ike had in the epilogue just about, as we honor Dr. King, what we do to his legacy while ignoring continued poverty rates and inequities among different classes of people and different races. And I just found what he said to be very honoring of Dr. King's life and work, and very damning of what we do with it and how we portray it in our history books. And
telling me that Ronald Reagan didn't have good anti-racist intentions when he created Martin Luther King Holiday?
Yeah, and there's also a mention of that in the book, of how he didn't actually want to do that, but it prevented him from doing actual things that were going to make
shocked.
A difference for black people. So
I'm floored.
Anyway. That was a very good biography. I also appreciated, so I started listening to it, and then I ran out of time and had to return it to the library and then had to finish reading the physical copy. What I did appreciate about the audiobook is it is read by a black man, even though it's not written by a black man. I just appreciated that they use black voices to tell the story. And to speak in the words of King and all of that, I thought that was really well done. And the person who read it, I don't remember his name, but he did a great job. I read two fabulous collections of essays, both by Ann Patchett. One of them was This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and the other one was These Precious Days. I highly, highly recommend both of those. And as much as I love Ann Patchett's fiction, I think I might like her nonfiction better. I think I'm finally ready to admit that. I just think she's an incredible person. And the way that she writes about everyday things with beauty and grace and honesty is just very compelling. Both of these books made me cry. These Precious Days ends... And I was sobbing. I was glad that I was home alone because I was listening to it. And anyway, I highly recommend both of those. I think everything she does is golden, but those two collections are really good, especially if you just like don't want to get caught up in a story, or you don't have time for a story, you just have time for an essay here and there, those are both really great. I listened to them both and then bought both of them physical copies because I'd like to own them. I read a delightful children's book called Ferris by the beautiful Kate DiCamillo. And that book was actually recommended to me by Ann Patchett on her Facebook page through Parnassus Books. So they are friends, and they're both lovely people. And one of her essays in, I think, These Precious Days is actually about how she met Kate and how they became professional colleagues and then friends. So that's just sweet. And it's all about how Kate DiCamillo helped her love children's fiction. And now Ann Patchett has written a children's book. Anyway.
Have you read it?
I have not. It's, I want you guys to get it at the library when you go, if they have it. But
okay.
Anyway, Ferris was wonderful. It's about this girl's relationship with her grandmother and this ghost that's in their house and how they help the ghost find peace on the other side, and just really exploring Ferris's place within the family. And she has a very chaotic little sister. And it just seemed very reminiscent of things that happen at our house now, except this child is way more chaotic than Posey. So
really,
she pulled out her teeth with pliers.
Whoa!
Like, so we don't have that yet, but
that's wild.
The book itself is fabulous. It's very colorful. It's very sweet. There's a relation, like all of Kate's book have. Kate's books have like a pretty central relationship to some type of animal, and she makes me care about animals. You guys.
Take notes, Eleanor Estes.
I know, we'll get to that. But Ferris was fantastic. It's very quick read. I listened to it, and the person reading it was fabulous as well. I read Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf.
Did you talk about that last time?
No, you did, so I'm not going to touch on it, but I enjoyed it.
It's good. It's a good book.
I also read Anxious People by Frederick Bachman, I think that's his name. The same guy that wrote the book that the movie that Tom Hanks is in was based off of, The Man Which Called movie? Otto. Remember that movie?
But yeah,
the book has a
vaguely
different title. I remember our friend Maggie was upset that they changed the title of the movie. That's not the man's name in the book, but it's the same story. I don't know why they changed it. Regardless, this book is kind of like a whodunit sort of situation, and it's told through the perspectives of a lot of different people who have been like mistakenly in this hostage situation that no one intended. So it's very intriguing. It's very interesting. It's all about these different relationships of these people that build in this one apartment over this one particular day. It was enjoyable. It was a lot of back and forth for me, which was not my favorite. Like, it just jumps to a lot of different perspectives. And it would make one conclusion, but then go back on the conclusion a little later and then make another one and undo that one. And I'm just wondering if I would have enjoyed it more if I was reading it physically than listening to it. But I would read more of his books. I read The Magician's Assistant by Ann Patchett, which was very, very good. It's one of her novels. I'm talking a lot, so I'm not going to dive deep into all of these. But I did enjoy it more than Patron Saint of Liars, which I talked about last time.
Is that the last fiction book you read of hers besides this one?
Yes. I read A Trick of the Light, which is the next book in the Louise Penny series. Those are always fun. I can't read a lot of them all at once because I get kind of tired, and you notice some of her patterns that kind of get on my nerves. But those books are still really enjoyable, and I'm glad they exist, and they're fun little murder mysteries. I read Class, a memoir of motherhood, which is Stephanie Land's second memoir. She made her debut with Maid, and this is like continuing her journey in college as she is also raising her daughter and has another daughter. And I love everything. I love her writing style. I love how honest she is with her story. And also, she's just a very good storyteller, and helps you look at systems and where they're flawed, but also recognizing that we are flawed humans within flawed systems. And so bad things happen, and we need to have grace and compassion for one another. And I think she does that really well. Her tribute to her girls at the end, again, made me cry because it was so beautiful. I read How to Say Babylon by Sophia Sinclair. This book is about a woman who was raised Rastafarian, and her father was very abusive, and it's really just exploring her journey within her religion, but also within her home, which was very chaotic, and her like writing and books was an escape for her, and that's really how she was able to make a life for herself and kind of leave behind parts of her religion that were harmful for her. I think she does a good job of exploring how, and in her religious setting, which I think is true in a lot of them, like things that are very like condemning for some people can mean different things to others and aren't necessarily like abusive in and of themselves, but it's how, it's about your consent and it's about your free will within them, especially as a child. Like, how are you growing up with this, and what is it saying about your worth and your, you know, just your place as a woman. I think she does a good job of exploring how different sects within Rastafari culture say very different things to people that can be meaningful to some, and then in certain sects can be harmful to others. And so I just feel like she handled that well without condemning her whole background. And then I read Family of Liars by E. Lockhart, which is the prequel to We Are Liars, which I read a couple years ago when my sweet friend Maggie gave it to me. And that book is about rich teenagers who just explores what money and power and wealth can do to people. And I think it's a really good story. And it's your turn. That was a lot. Sorry.
That's all right. I've not read as many books. I've read three since our last podcast. So I'll go in reverse chronological order. The most recent book I read, my pastor Caleb gave me this book. It's called The Vocation of a Teacher, Rhetorical Occasions, 1967 to 1988. And it's by this guy named Wayne C. Booth. And it's basically just a bunch of collected writings and speeches by this guy, Wayne Booth, who I was not familiar with until reading this book, but he's important enough to have a Wikipedia page. So he's kind of a important figure in higher ed, like specifically with English rhetoric and like that sort of like rhetorical analysis, like writing and rhetoric as a field of study, which was a big deal when I was in grad school. A lot of the stuff that I did as a teaching assistant was around that. And so it was kind of interesting to like dip my toe back into this, although this guy was writing in like the, like as Ozir said, like the 60s to the 80s. And I thought, my pastor said when he gave it to me, this is a little old-fashioned, but some of the stuff you've talked about being a teacher, like, seems like it resonates here. And I assumed when he said old-fashioned that it would mean that the issues were out of date. And I was surprised to find that they weren't. He talks a lot about how, like, a liberal arts education is increasingly being compromised in higher ed by people who are, like, obsessed with vocational training or focus on the wrong things, like how people are more obsessed with how people can spell words correctly than to actually articulate their points correctly, and things like that that we're still dealing with today. And honestly, like, I mean, Wayne Booth is dead now. He died in like 2005 or 6 or something like that. But I'd be very curious to see what he would think about the world of higher ed now that the liberal arts is even more beleaguered by those sort of like, you know, forces. So that was cool. I didn't love this book. Sorry, Caleb. First of all, it's kind of hard to read like a collection like this just front to back, especially because he talks a lot about the same issues, like just over time. You know, he had a beat that he followed in academia, and he spoke on that same beat a lot. And so a lot of these essays or speeches kind of covered the same ground, so it got a little tedious after a while. The other thing I didn't love about it, and this is not exactly his fault, but like, this is, I think, what my pastor meant, is that he sounds like a mid-century academic, which has been parodied so many times, but, like, is just an insufferable voice to listen to or to read. You know, like, very, like, always making references to Aristotle and, like, classical antiquity. Very bemused, but not especially sympathetic to, like, youth culture, and, like, kind of snide about, like, just, like, things outside of academia. Like, I did not enjoy this guy's writing voice, but I say that acknowledging that, like, the way he was writing is just the way that a lot of people were trained to write as, like, college or graduate school educated people. And I think, I don't know, a lot of what he said, he seemed very self-impressed with, because I think that's, like, the voice that a lot of, like, older academics have. And it's not really a character flaw, but I think, like, it feels out of touch with kind of, I think a lot of academics now are intentionally self-deprecating. And I don't know, it got a little old to read after a while, but I appreciated the points he made, which I broadly agree with. The next book that I read previous to that was another Virginia Woolf novel. So I guess last time I talked about Mrs. Dalloway, which I was rereading. And this time I read a book by Virginia Woolf that I haven't read before, called Orlando, but Rebecca's read this mm-hmm. one. Anyway, I read this one as preparation to the book that we're all three reading, me, Rebecca, and our friend Andrew, which is called The Waves, which I've not started yet. But Orlando is a book that Virginia Woolf wrote, like, basically about, it was one of her lovers, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about that person, but it was inspired by this person that
Orlando's based after her.
Right.
Yeah.
But what Orlando is, like, it's like a fake biography. Like, it's mm-hmm. Orlando colon a biography mm-hmm. is the full title of the book. And it's just reads like an old-fashioned biography for a little while about this guy who's, like, basically in Elizabethan England, whose name is Orlando, and he's, like, an aspiring poet, and, like, falls in love with, like, a Russian princess, and, like, just kind of, like, things seem to be going along, like, normal, kind of, like, hobnobs with, like, Samuel Johnson and William Shakespeare and, like, the kind of, like, you know, literati of the time. But eventually Orlando, for reasons that aren't really worth going into, like, becomes a consulate to Constantinople. And while in Constantinople, basically transforms into a woman
With no explanation of why.
Well, there is sort of an explanation. The explanation is, like, these angels come down from heaven and bestow,
right.
like, a new gender upon Orlando. Right. But then Orlando returns to England as a woman and also apparently has become immortal. Because, like, Orlando lives through, like, the 16th, the 17th, the 18th, and the 19th century. And the book ends at the date of the publication of the book Orlando. And it's just a really odd book. It's a book that doesn't feel odd at first, but, like, as it goes on, it just becomes increasingly strange. There's apparently this other, like, literary critic who's also immortal, but is given no explanation for why he's immortal, and Orlando kind of hates him because he's just a crank and, like, cynical and all that. But it is a very intriguing book, and I'm not exactly sure what to make of it exactly. I mean, I think, like, obvious thing from a 21st century lens is, like, oh, this is about gender and transness and stuff. And I mean, those sorts of things were kind of floating in the periphery of Virginia Woolf's world at the time, but, like, the way that people thought about gender and, you know, even the idea of being a, like, a transgendered person
mm-hmm.
was not exactly the same as what we think of it now. And so it's kind of interesting to read about that. There's some exploration of, like when Orlando first becomes a woman, like, there's a lot of thoughts about, like, who am I, like, now that I'm a woman, like, oh, am I different? And, like, there's some, those sorts of, like, gender as, like, a performance or gender as construct sort of thing that, you know, that a lot of people now talk about that feels really prescient. But there's other things that feel very, like, locked into, like, the time period that Virginia Woolf was. And so, you know, like, there's a lot of, there are some elements of it that feel kind of like gender essentialist, like Orlando as a person, like, her personality changes when she becomes a woman mm-hmm. and, like, things like that, that, you know, I think that a lot of people now would say, like, well, if you change genders, your personality wouldn't change. And also, like, it feels very of its time in the sense of it is very situated within the British Empire. you know, everything that Orlando does, Orlando is basically aristocracy. There's a big subplot in the book about, like, can Orlando keep her property now that she's a woman? Because she was, like, landed gentry when she was a man, and now that she's a woman, can a woman keep Orlando's property, Orlando the man's property? And, you know, all of those are kind of questions of, like, feminism, but they're also, like, questions of the feminism of aristocrats, right? And, like, you know, Orlando going to Constantinople, like, into the Ottoman Empire, like, only exists as a function of, like, you know, kind of imperial reach at the time, not specifically the British Empire, obviously, but, like, I read apparently that it was really common for British people to go to the Ottoman Empire because, like, some of the social mores were different there, and so you could experiment with identity and stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, that's only really meaningful within, like, the context in which, like, there are these large empires, you know, that kind of govern huge sections of the world. And, like, by the time Virginia Woolf was writing in, like, the, you know, late 1920s, like, writing this book, like, that had begun to crumble. But it was still, like, the world that she was brought up in. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's, like, a weird book that's, like, simultaneously of its time, but also feels like something that people would be interested in the 20th century and someone might write in the 20th century. I don't know. I found it interesting. I don't quite know what to do with it as much as I know Mrs. Dalloway, which I think mm-hmm. is a much cleaner novel.
Straightforward.
And more straightforward in terms of what it's going for. But really intriguing. I'm looking forward to The Waves. And the last book, that'll transition me to the last book I read, which was actually the one I read, like, not too long after we recorded our last podcast, which is a poetry collection called Pentimento, by Joshua Garcia. And this is actually a friend of ours that we knew in college. Josh was a fellow English major, fellow writer when we went to Union University. And he went on to, you know, do lots of other things. He got, you know, a degree at, I think, in South Carolina or something, mm-hmm. like a graduate degree, and then lives in New York now. But one of the things that kind of, like, happened in between then and now is he came out as gay and you know, has really embraced, like, you know, that element of himself, which Union being, like, a private Southern Baptist college,
or undergrad is Union,
correct? Right, yeah, the college we all went to, like, you know, that was not something that, like, he could be, like, that out about there without facing repercussions. And this poetry collection is largely about that. The like, kind of, like, him as, like, an older adult, like, not older in the sense of, like, the spectrum of human life, but old for a person to come out, you know, like, mid-20s, as opposed to, like, you know, coming out, like, earlier in life, like, kind of feeling a little bit behind, you know, and inexperienced as, like, a person who is gay. And how that intersects, like, some of his religious upbringing, and, like, it's a very religious and informed by Christian tradition, the text, although I think that a lot of Christians who are, you know, more conservative will probably take exception with, like, you know, the queer themes in it, but it's a really, I think, beautifully done, like, wrestling with, like, the faith of his upbringing versus the faith that he has now, and how that has changed alongside, like, his understanding of his sexuality, and not so much his understanding, which seems to have been, like, static throughout, but, like, his relationship to his sexuality throughout. And it, again, this is a poetry collection, I don't read a ton of poetry, but I do try to read when friends of mine publish poetry, which I have a lot of friends who publish poetry, mm-hmm. and I think this is a really good one. And there's probably no chance that Josh is listening to this, but I really did enjoy it. And I'm sorry if I've explained it wrong, Josh, but I highly recommend it to anyone who those themes sound intriguing. And even if they don't sound intriguing, like, I think that, like, the emotional landscape that it covers is worth wrestling with. Especially if you're still within Christianity. It's very reverent, but also very honest about the ways that, you know, Christianity as it's practiced a lot, leaves a mark on the people that it deems unclean or, you know, outside. And anyway, pentimento, it's a good one. That, yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Eleanor Estes. Eleanor Estes. Is that how you say her name?
Estes? You know, I will say my mom is a huge fan of Eleanor Estes and read these, a lot of her books, when I was a little bit older. So she wasn't reading them to me. She was reading them to, like, my younger siblings. And she's always said Eleanor Estes. Okay. I'm not sure if that is correct. However,
this person, this woman, let me tell you a little bit about her life. She was, like many of our authors that we've encountered in this journey reading the Newbery Medal winners, she was born in West Haven, Connecticut in 1906. She was the third child of her dad was a bookkeeper for a railway, and then her mom was a seamstress. Her father died when she was really young, and so her mother had to continue working with dressmaking to provide for the family. Eleanor attributes her love of reading and of children's literature to her parents, specifically to her mom, who loved books and would tell them these beautiful stories while she was cooking dinner. If that
wouldn't
doesn't
that be
sound
amazing,
like most wholesome.
As someone who has tried to cook dinner with children around, like spinning yarns as you're trying to cook dinner, that's amazing.
It's a very sweet image. It also sounds like it's out of a very cloying movie that we wouldn't like. But I'm glad that that was her memory of her childhood. After she graduated high school, she trained at the New Haven Free Library, and she became a children's librarian there. In 1931, she won the special scholarship for children's librarians, which allowed her to study at the Pratt Institute Library School in New York, which is where she met her husband, Rice Estes.
His name is Rice?
Yes. His name is Rice. She married him in 1932. They both worked as librarians, which I think sounds so sweet. And he became a professor of library science and the head of the Pratt Institute Library, which is where they met. She worked as a librarian until 1941 when she got tuberculosis, which left her confined to her bed, and that's when she began writing. She wrote about another fictional family that's set in the same town as Ginger Pie, which is Cranberry, Connecticut, which I told you wrong. Cranberry, Connecticut is not a real town, but it was based off of her hometown, West
Haven. Oh, wait, West Haven.
Yeah.
Wait, so there's New Haven, there's West Haven. Is there an East Haven, a South Haven, a North Haven?
I don't know. But anyway.
How many havens are there in Connecticut? A lot of havens for writers.
The other family that she wrote about in that same, like, world are the Moffats, which she was very famous for writing about that family. She had one child, Helena, who was born in Los Angeles in 1948, which is where her husband was an assistant library at the University of Southern California. Then in 1952, they moved back east, and they were both working as librarians again. She died in July of 1988 in Hamden, Connecticut, at the age of 82. And in addition to winning the Newbery Medal for Ginger Pie, she won many other awards. She won the Newbery Honor for the Middle Moffat in 1942, and then again won the Newbery Honor for The Hundred Dresses in 1944. She also won the Lewis Carroll Shelf Award for The Moffats in 1941. She was a Laura Ingalls Wilder Award nominee in 1970. She won the Certificate of Award for Outstanding Contribution to Children's Literature in 1968 and the Pratt Institute Alumni Medal in 1968. So, she had a full life with a lot of books and a lot of writing and a lot of awards. And why don't you tell us about Ginger Pie?
Yeah, so Ginger Pie is about, well, Ginger is a dog, but it's really about this brother and sister whose names are Jerry and Rachel, who are kids who are like elementary school age kids living in Cranberry, Connecticut. They want a dog. And
Jerry wants a dog.
They already have a cat. They're worried that the cat's not going to like the dog. But eventually they think, oh, yeah, I think this cat will probably like our dog. But then Jerry's got to earn money.
A dollar.
A whole U.S. dollar to get a dog. And so they work dusting church pews to earn this dollar. They get Ginger Pie. They have some great times with Ginger Pie. Their last name is Pie, by the way. I don't know if I said that. But then Ginger Pie goes missing. And they're not sure where Ginger Pie has gone. They're really bummed about Ginger Pie being missing. And eventually they find Ginger Pie again in circumstances that are spoilers. So I guess if you're spoiler averse, don't listen to this. But it turns out that this family named the... Oh, shoot. What is their name?
The Bullwinkles.
Yeah. This family named the Bullwinkles. It was not like a large family. It's just a father and his son, Wally, have stolen Ginger Pie, put up a beware of dog sign on their fence that you can't see over, and told stories about this big scary dog that they have to like make sure people don't investigate what's in this fence. But it's just really Ginger in behind this fence. And Wally's dad has like roots in vaudeville, and so they're going to run off and become vaudeville performers, and they want Ginger Pie to come with them and be part of their Broadway act. And at the end of this book, they're leaving and to go be part of the vaudeville act, and Benny, who is the uncle of Rachel and Jerry, but also like a 3-year-old or something, because Jerry and Rachel's mom is super young and Jerry and Rachel's dad is super old, which is a weird thing that they accentuate on. But anyway, as a consequence, they have a very young uncle. But Benny sees that Ginger is there as they're moving and tells everyone and saves the day. And so Benny's the hero and they get Ginger back. And the Bullwinkles are run out of town or put in jail or something like that. I don't exactly remember what happens to them. I read this book a month ago. And yeah, that's what the book's about.
Yeah.
Well, Rebecca, what did you think of Ginger Pie? What did you like about it? Let's start with what you liked about it. It's been so long since we did this podcast, I forgot our format.
Okay, you can give it a rest, okay?
I've forgiven you, but I just need to explain why I'm being a poor host.
Okay.
Co-host.
I really enjoyed the brother-sister dynamic in this book. I think any good sibling relationship, I am all here for. I think it's really sweet. They do adventures together. They seem to care for one another. Their relationship with their uncle is sweet, Uncle Benny, he's kind of like another little brother to them. I just think they're like the Three Musketeers, even though they're like separate in age and everything, and I just think they're really sweet. Another thing that I appreciate about books set in this time, or even not just in this time, even in our childhood, which I feel like we haven't read enough modern winters yet to tell if it's any different, but like there's so much time of kids just exploring the world without adults around, which I don't necessarily think is the way things need to be, but it makes for a really good story that you can envision yourself in. It's like, what would I do if I were just forging my own way during the day? Like, they have a lot of time with their parents. I'm not saying they don't, but there's a lot of episodes where it's just them trying to figure out life with this dog and life with other people in the town. And I just think that makes for like a fun story of like kids figuring out the world on their own. I think that's one of the things that we really enjoyed about the Mixed Up Files is like just these kids forging their own path and just having a lot of adventures without adults around, which makes for good insight into their behavior and their ideas and good questions about how the world works. So I enjoyed that about books set in this time of like, it was probably a lot more realistic for those like unsupervised adventures to happen than maybe they do now, where adult supervision is so much more heightened. I don't know if I'm correct about that.
This book takes place not in 1952, by the way, but in 1919.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention that.
I didn't realize that. I forgot it.
I had forgotten about it until I looked at Wikipedia, and then as I was flipping back through this book, you can see the illustrations, which are done by Eleanor Estes, by the way, And I looked at one of the cars, and it's like a Model T and stuff. And so it does make sense that it
takes
place.
That's interesting why it's that year when she would have been 13 at that time. So
are they supposed to be that old? Maybe. I mean, this definitely feels like a book that's like informed by like childhood memories.
Yeah. So I really like those aspects of the book. What did you like?
I like those aspects of the book too. I think this book is sometimes pretty funny. Like I think it does a good job of, we can get into like character development later, but it does a good job of like initially sketching the characters. Like when you first meet a character, they're kind of like vividly sketched out. Like Jerry and Rachel both have very precise personalities that are established really early and like immediately at the beginning of the book. Wally Bullwinkle, you see him and you know he's up to no good, you know, immediately. He's kind of memorably kind of like sour. They have this friend who's this older kid named Sam Duty. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's the one that gets them the job that pays them the dollar, which allows them to buy ginger pie in the first place.
First of all, I like that his name is Duty. And second of all, he's not a particularly interesting character as the book goes on, but like he is like, you immediately recognize like the kind of person that he is. And he's not quite an archetype, but like, He you can see who he is and everything that he does makes sense from just that little sketch of him onward. So I think that this book does a good job of doing that. And like I said, I think some of it's funny. Like the opening chapters are all about their kind of deliberation about how to like get this dog. And it goes into a lot of their existing family, which is Jerry and Rachel, and then they have a cat named
Pinky.
Pinky.
Who has her own book.
Yeah, the sequel to this book, which is good because Pinky does not get very much page time, page space in this book. But they also talk about their mother and father. Their father is like a bird researcher, like an ornithologist.
Right.
Is what would you call a bird?
Yeah,
studier, ornithologist.
Yeah, because
he's got a book coming out on birds.
Rachel
that's
wants
be a big
to
deal.
Do the same thing and go with him and do those things.
It's yeah, sweet. And. Anyway, like, some of the stuff with birds is, like, funny, and, like, again, like, it's just kind of, like, this interesting, quirky guy that is their father. And there's, like, a few, like, people in the town who are just kind of, like, comically sketched out. Like, there's this guy named Bitnose Ned that Wally claims, like, his ferocious dog, which turns out to be Ginger, but Wally claims his dog is so ferocious that he was the dog who bit Bitnose Ned's nose. And I think that's funny. The cat, like as I was mentioning earlier, like all the deliberation about like, is our cat actually going to get along with the dog? Like, would it be a betrayal of our cat to get a dog? Like, it's not like laugh out loud funny, but it's like amusing. And I liked the way that it like kind of rendered those sorts of like very small scale dramas. It rendered them in a way that was like... kind of bemused at the children while also taking them seriously. And I enjoyed that aspect of the book. There's a chapter that's from the perspective of Ginger the dog, and it's all about how Ginger keeps seeing reflections of himself and thinking it's another dog, which is like, I guess, kind of like a stock trope of like animals or whatever, but it's fun. It's kind of funny how
enemy dog.
The enemy dog, right, is how it's described, and like he sees it in like a reflection in a lake and jumps into the lake and things like that. And so like I liked the kind of like whimsical and kind of lighthearted, you know, lightly comical like tone throughout the book. That was good. And I like the things you're talking about too. Like I think the relationship between the brother and sister is strong. I like their adventures, although I wish they veered more toward hijinks.
Yeah.
They're not very hijinks-like. They're just more like things that they did that I'm sure were fun for them to do. And if I were a child, it might be fun to imagine myself doing them. But I wanted them to get into some scrapes, which they don't.
Yeah.
Tom Sawyer is evoked at one point. And Tom Sawyer, for whatever books or whatever flaws that book has, like it's a classic of child getting into scrapes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these kids could have stood to... You know,
get into
more, you know, witness protection situations or whitewashing fences sorts of things.
Yes.
Anyway, what didn't you like about this book?
I found this book to be boring, unfortunately. I tell people, I'm like, I don't mind books about dogs, but there has to be compelling things that are happening with the human characters for me to be invested. And I didn't particularly think anything they were doing was interesting. Everything is related to this dog, but the dog itself is not that interesting.
I actually have to say, everything is not related to this dog.
Okay.
Like, for... And I'm not saying this to disagree with you. I'm saying that the human element is not as interesting as it could be because the dog goes missing, which should
be a
big traumatic thing, but they still keep going along in their, like, whimsical adventures.
They try to find him and stuff, and they...
But it doesn't dramatize it in a way that's like, wow, I really feel for these poor kids. It's like, aw, shucks, our dog is missing. What are we going to do?
Yeah. I also had forgotten about the problematic age difference between the dad and the, I think he's like 35 when he marries their mom, and she is 17, you guys.
So my first thought when they first mentioned that fact in the book is like, well, it was a different time, and it was a different time. However, the book goes out of its way to say how everyone in the town thinks it's so weird that she's like half his age. Like,
didn't they lie? Or something? I can't remember.
The book itself portrays it as weird, which makes me feel okay in thinking it's strange and gross that this old man, I say old man, but he's like my age. But
And they meet because he's running up an escalator and he knocks her down and then they like fall in love.
And that would be fine, except that she's a child, basically.
Right. It's a fun meet cute, but yeah, she's a kid. Anyway, that's problematic. But I wanted this book to be funnier. I think it had the capacity to be funny, and it wasn't. I also would have liked to know more things about Wally Bullwinkle, this guy that takes the dog. You kind of get like these little glimpses of him all along, but only in terms of like he wants to take this dog.
He's always just like scowling.
I want to know what's compelling about this dog for him. What does he need Ginger for? Like, what?
Yeah, you have to imagine, like, they're kind of like a transient family. His dad has kind of like, you know, a kind of like disreputable background, having been in vaudeville, and like he doesn't have a mom that's in the picture.
Yeah.
And like, I can imagine a version of this story that was kind of poignant where he wanted a dog because his life felt like he wasn't cared for, and like, you know, he wanted a dog, or maybe he felt like he needed protection, and that's why he put up the signs about like, you know, a vicious dog don't come through.
And I do wonder, this is the only book that we've read of her, so I wonder if you meet this family in some of the Moffat's books, or maybe they come back up in Pinkie Pie. I do think there's a lot more space for her to flesh out that character, and I hope that she did. I won't be reading to find out, but I hope that she did.
Dang.
But I did think, as I say that, I think one thing I did appreciate about this book is that Wally is very hateful to Jerry and Rachel. And we know as the reader, like, you can tell that he's the one that's taken Ginger before Jerry
like
and Rachel
find out. 150 pages before they figure out. Like, the minute Ginger Pie is missing, they're talking about how Wally is always, like, looking furtive off to the side.
But what I do like is we as the reader have that perspective while Jerry and Rachel don't. And they are just kind to Wally, and they don't understand why all out of the blue he's being really nasty to them. And that, to me, is true to childhood and to life in general. Like, people who are jealous of you or think you have something that they need, or they really covet what you want, or they really desire what you have, can often be really nasty to you, and it feel like it's coming out of nowhere. Like, where is this? What have I done wrong? And I did appreciate that aspect of the book, of having Jerry and Rachel just kind of wonder, like, what has happened here? And them still show him kindness even through that. I thought that was a very sweet part of the book and very true to childhood. The last thing I'll say is these illustrations were not good.
Yeah, she went to library college, not art college, you can tell.
I just wish she would have hired an illustrator.
Yeah, I agree. They're very sketch-like and rudimentary, and I don't know. They don't really add anything to the story. They just kind of look amateurish.
Yep.
That said, I'm looking at some of these drawings, and they're better than what I could do. So maybe, those in glass houses should not cast stones, but...
That's why if I ever wrote a children's book, I would not be doing my own illustrations.
That's true.
Anyway, what did you dislike?
Mostly the same stuff you did. I went into this remembering my mom really liked this, and at the beginning, like I mentioned, I was amused. Like it wasn't like hilarious, but it was kind of like, you know, gently funny. But then once they get the dog, like all the stakes go away, like all the narrative drive goes away. Nothing interesting happens to them. Even once their dog is gone and kidnapped, for whatever reason, even though they're like every once in a while being like, gosh, I wonder where Ginger is, it doesn't create like a like tension in the book. It doesn't, it's just kind of like, it becomes like an emptiness in the book. Like, oh wow, Ginger's gone. We're sad about that, kind of. I don't know. Like, it just felt like the book felt emptier than it should have been. Like, the Bullwinkle stuff, like we mentioned, felt very underdeveloped, despite the fact that could be super interesting. Like, vaudeville act? Like, come on. Like, that sounds amazing to know about. There's other stuff, too, that is, like, kind of left hanging, and we don't really know any details about it that might have been really interesting. Like, for instance, one thing we haven't mentioned but is kind of fun that Jerry and Rachel do is they tell each other this improvised story when they're in bed, like at night. They're going to sleep. And it's about this guy named, I can't remember. They invented this guy, and each night, like, they tell a new section of this guy's story. Boombernickels. That's the guy's name. And when Ginger is gone, they stop telling the story because they're too sad to tell it. And that's, like, a great touch, and that's, like, a great little, like, detail about these characters. But we don't know anything about this story. Like, we just hear, oh, they just tell each other stories about Boombernickels. And I can imagine what they're telling the stories about. But, like, I can also imagine that this book would have been so much more engaging if we learned about what they were saying to Boombernickels, because then it would make a difference when they stopped telling the stories. When we're like, wow, they're no longer having these connections. But it's so abstract how it's rendered in the book. Like, we don't know what kind of stories Boombernickels, is a part of. We don't know what it's like when they tell each other these stories. We just know that they tell these stories, and then at one point they stop. And that's kind of how a lot of this book is, where it kind of sketches something out. And like I said, those initial sketches are really intriguing and interesting. But then it neglects to fill in the details later on that would develop the story into something that was engaging the whole time, rather than just kind of interesting conceptually. And I feel that about a lot of the book, is that, like, I think conceptually, like, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, but in practice it's not that filled in. It's kind of like the illustrations themselves, which are very spare, kind of like charming in their own way, but spare, and could have been filled out a lot more. And I don't know, I just wish that this book had more going for it. And instead, you get all these, like, this really, and a lot of children's books are like this, but this very episodic and slack plot where it's like, today we went to the creek, and today we went to the junkyard, and, like, you know, just sort of like random stuff like that. And those are fine if you can make interesting stuff out of it, but a lot of the stuff ceases to be interesting, because after a while, there's just this void of detail to give nuance or life to anything. And so it eventually becomes kind of tedious following these characters around, because you don't know anything more about these characters than you did 100 pages ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's harsher than I actually... Well, I'm saying stuff that feels harsh. I don't, like, hate this book, but I just... It's one of those books that you can kind of feel the potential of it, mm-hmm. and I don't feel like it ever achieves that potential. Although, yeah. I guess in 1952, people felt differently.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, she's definitely made, like, huge contributions to children's literature, and I don't want to undermine those. This wasn't my cup of tea.
Mine.
So, I do give it a thumbs down.
Thumbs down. House unified once again.
But we are happy to announce that we have chosen our next book, which is Island of the Blue Dolphins, which won in 1961.
Scott Odell.
We have both read that book before and both have fond memories of it. So we're hoping...
I don't actually remember anything at all about this book.
I remember, actually, Kara loved this book. This was one of her favorite books.
Kara being one of Rebecca's friends from middle school that we keep touch with as adults. But
keep touch with.
We're friends with still as adults. Just For anyway, whoever is out there listening, yes, that he doesn't know our personal lives. I also remember positive things about Island of the Blue Dolphins, but I don't remember anything about it, so it'll be one of those things, yeah, where I'm re-experiencing it for the first time.
I am hopeful that we can end our saga of thumbs down, though.
Yeah, we've had a real big streak of
those. It's been for a long time, and I don't want people to think that we are Debbie Downers on books. We love books, and we
should change this to the Newbery haters.
We have not loved these past few books, but
the
I'm
Newbery
hopeful
decimators.
That's changing. Before we end, I would also like to give a shout out to our new friend, Peter Bryan, who has been listening to our podcast and reached out and sent us an email. That was just the highlight of our week back in March.
Back in March. Was that really the last time we recorded
yes,
a podcast?
It was 3 days before he sent this email. Isn't that embarrassing?
Gosh.
I'm really sorry.
So it's
sorry,
not been
you guys.
1 month, it's been two.
It's been several. I'm sorry. That was my fault. But, Peter, thank you for reaching out and sending us an email, and thank you for listening to
everyone. You're the first known stranger listening
right
to this podcast.
We are appreciative of all of our listeners, but just wanted to give Peter a shout-out because he doesn't know us and is enjoying the podcast and sent us an email, and that just made our day. So if there's others of you out there that don't know us, we'd love to get to know you.
NewberryChronicles@gmail.com. Yeah. Newberry has one R.
Email
That's
us.
That's confused me many a time.
Yeah. So, I think that's all we have.
That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Especially Peter, if you're listening.
If you haven't given up on us yet.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope everyone has a good evening. Hope everyone liked ginger pie better than we did.
See ya.
Bye.